in brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust and blues you can trust. Indigos feel and white ones heal. Yellow scare and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Marge face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Volkelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast,
episode 556.
That is right. We are talking about Green Lantern issue number 10 from Adams and Zermanico. Let's just jump right into it, I guess.
Yes, and I'm going to do my best not to editorialize as I do the summary of the main story, because I got things to say about it. But I'm going to try not to say it till we do our discussion point. So the title cover, anyway, is Hal Jordan, Fugitive, which reminds me of the Venditti days. No gauntlet, but it does remind me of that. So we pick up where we left off on Oa with Joe and Hal. Hal's looking for explanation about what's been going on, and Joe kind of is telling him, no, not here. She starts mentioning ring hunters, which we get more of an explanation for in a little bit. They end up in the... underneath all the tunnels and underneath all the mechanics and all the technology in Oa, where we basically find out that there's like a teeny conclave of some lanterns that really know what's going on here. They're figuring out what's going on, and they're hiding from United Planets and their lanterns. And we see our friend Salak, probably the most excited people are going to be to see Salak in a long time. And 2-6, I was quite happy to see 2-6. So was Hal, as he actually gives her a hug. I don't know how much real experience they've had together, even though I guess when they started the Venditti run, I guess technically there was a little bit of interaction between those characters. That we see Kyle there too. Kyle's a friggin' mess because he is sensing how the emotional spectrum is completely out of balance and all messed up, and how it's got to be fixed. And Hal's reassuring him that they can put it back together again. Joe gives Hal the primer about what's going on here. And basically there's United Planet Lanterns that basically are magic users that have been given Green Lantern rings. And it's via their connection to magic, it's why they're able to swap emotional spectrum colors, which I guess on some level explains why regular Green Lanterns are having so much trouble against the spectrum, because it's not just a science-based shift. It's a magical induced shift. And how veteran lanterns have been sent out to far into space, and miraculously enough, shortly they never came back, but their rings were, so they were being killed. And Lord Premier Tharos is the one behind all of it, which we've kind of suspected for a while. We see, speaking of Tharos, down in Oa, we see the Source Lantern, which is, I guess, that multicolored lantern pseudo power battery that we saw that was created in the Thorn run. And they're trying to master the spectrum to tap into the real power of the emotional spectrum, but the United Planet Lanterns yet cannot do that. Everybody who tries keeps dying. So she mentions that there's like basically a mole they have from the United Planets feeding them information. And this is Jessica, which again is no great surprise, because we saw that. We could have inferred that probably based on what we saw in the last issue. Simon is here, and for better or for worse, he's got a ring again. And we find out that they have Kelly. I kind of knew this was going to be Kelly based on the way they were setting this up. We'll talk about that too. They're experimenting on Kelly and her gauntlet, who I guess she's still in a frigging coma since the last book. And they're trying to tap into Kelly to see if they can figure out using her gauntlet or her connection to the gauntlet as another way of connecting to the emotional spectrum. Joe and Simon keep cautioning Hal, oh, you can't do this, you can't leap into action, because there's these lanterns using like Manhunter tech or whatever can basically negate the Green Lantern rings. Hal is Hal. He says, well, you can't just let Joe, the Kelly stay down there. So he goes to engage these, you know, these Manhunter wearing armor, wearing sentries. We find out quickly that the ring that Hal has from the Earthbound Foundry is not affected by these pseudo Manhunters, that they cannot just turn off or negate the rings. They try to rescue Kelly. Kelly gets taken away. As they end up in, because they're in the science cells and during all this, they do find Hal, at least gets a little bit of satisfaction because he finds Razor. So he busts Razor out along with this bird-like lantern that's been a thorn in Hal's side for a couple of issues now. And they basically start shaking him down for information to find out what exactly is going on. Theros tells Jessica to go to the Unseeing, which are the magic users, to, because they need to find where these hidden lanterns are. And we see three blind floating magic users, the Unseeing, saying, your request has been foretold and we have answered. The resistance has been found. And the next issue will be Wedding Bells, which is interesting. And this, so now the actual title of the issue, because this is one of those jobs where the title page is at the very end. The more things change, writer Jeremy Adams, artist Germanico and Amanse Nachupan, colorist Romulo Fajard Jr., Dave Sharp, letterer, Germanico, cover artist, Evan Doc Shaner, Jorge Fornes, and Michael Walsh were variant cover artists. Jillian Grant, assistant editor, and Paul Kaminsky remains the editor.
Meanwhile, in a bar far, far away, we have Guy's Bogus Lobo Adventure Part 1, Gotcha, by Jeremy Adams, with artist Kevin McGuire, colorist Rosemary Cheatham, letterer Dave Sharp, assistant editor Jillian Grant, and editor Paul Kaminsky. We see Guy talking about how he's been looking for Lobo, and then on television or some sort of broadcast in the background at the bar, we hear a wrestling event being announced, and everybody's watching, and they're welcoming to the stage the main man. And of course, Guy's like, you gotta be fucking kidding me. So meanwhile, over on Metropolis, an hour later, Skeets gets a call while he's in his apartment with Booster Gold. And Guy Gardner's calling via Skeets. And he doesn't want to talk to Booster. He wants to talk to Skeets. And he's basically cheating and using Skeets to get future information about the Wrestling Across the Multiverse broadcast. And figure out, relative to their current point in the timeline, where was the next point they broadcasted from. So then, on the planet Valix, Valix 4, 3 days later, Guy is camped out on top of a building just waiting for them to show up. The Omega Bam Man and Krieg Maestro and Main Man are all teleported down. Guy interrupts their match, puts everybody in cuffs because it's an illegal broadcast. They take their fighters away, all except for the main man, who is wearing like a luchador mask and is handcuffed by Guy Gardner. Guy's like, hey, I've been looking for you, Lobo. You know, hey, you're coming with me. Tell it to the bureaucrats on Oa, because he's claiming he is not Lobo. That he is not who he says he is. He's like, yeah, sure, you're not. And he flies off with Lobo in tow, Lobo, quote unquote, in tow. Lobo whistles, and suddenly a pack of space dolphins is descending on them. And that ends our backup issue, and it says next, Space Dolphins. And the only thing else of relevance to mention here is that this is part of the current event, the House of Brainiac, which has a little blurb here that is relevant to our discussion on this part of the issue. House of Brainiac has arrived on planet Earth, ready to exact revenge on Superman with a Cesarnian army. But one special Cesarnian, Lobo, is still in the wind. Who will apprehend the main man? Perhaps we'll find out in Guy's Bogus Lobo Adventure. So when we say that this Cesarnian is claiming not to be a Lobo, when we know that Lobo is the only Cesarnian, there's a reason, because there are other Cesarnians in this event. So, but that ends our backup issue.
Good night, everybody. Hey, that was good. That was good. That was like a 10-minute episode. Let's go home, Chad.
Done.
If you'd like to contact us, don't. No. All right. So let's. If you want to talk about the backup, I guess we could start there because I don't know how much meat there really is in here to talk about.
Kai Gardner's a fucking cheater. Come on, using Skeets. It's also like a very Guy Gardner move.
So. Oh yeah.
I can't blame him.
it would have almost been even funnier if he was really cheating because he wanted to bet on the match, too.
That's true.
To find, because nothing says that you happen to be a completely 100% way too committed gambler, a gambling problem, if you're betting on professional wrestling.
Yeah, I thought it was an okay story for what it is. Obviously, it's a multi-part thing, so we don't get a whole lot of information in here. You know, one thing that's interesting, Guy Gardner has a construct and he's listening to a radio. I've always wondered how power rings are able to conjure up things like movies or music or whatever. Like, is it all based on what's in the imagination, or do they have like a central database they can access? And he's like, hey, just play, you know, the Beatles, Abbey Road or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's always up in the air because it's, and again, and you can explain it away with different rings too. Cause I think we had the idea with like with Kyle's ring and stuff. It's like, well, Kyle could only make like a construct pizza technically if he knew how to actually make a pizza and things like that. So it's even borderline how you could actually theoretically make a radio that's actually going to play, just because of the fact that unless you actually know how to physically build that device. But I think there's always some wiggle room in that. Obviously the wrestling stuff was cool. Having the Hulk Hogan tie-ins were pretty good. I am a real galaxy.
Also, hey, Kevin Maguire is our artist. Kevin Maguire of Justice League International fame, at least what, the first 24 issues or so of that series. I think it went for a long time, but I think it was only the first part of the series that Kevin Maguire was the artist. So having him draw Guy, all good. I did think the flat top haircut was weird for Guy. I don't know what his haircut looked like last time we saw him. When they gave him the Lobo assignment, I guess would have been the last time we saw him, but it was weird.
I like the flat. I think they have gotten, I think, generally speaking, kind of away from the flat top, but I do like the flat top. I mean, yeah. Because it's kind of reminiscent of the bowl cut, but yet it's much better than the bowl cut.
I don't know about better. He looks... speaking of the variant covers, my favorite variant cover of this particular issue by Doc Shaner, which is I made sure to put in our album art for this episode. I said he looked like, what's his name? Is it Sid? Is his name Sid in Christmas Story?
Oh, no. Oh, God. I know who you mean, but again, Christmas Story is not in my major wheelhouse. So,
Scott Farkas, that's his name.
Yes, Farkas.
Sorry. Yes. there's a variant cover by Doc Shaner, which is I have to buy this because I'm definitely going to. But you have Guy Gardner. You know, all the lanterns are flying like from page left to page right. So you have side profiles of everybody, including Guy, who is actually is standing stationary and he's turned his head facing the reader and he's got a construct baseball bat over his right shoulder and a little grin on his face, but there seems to be like a little gap in his front teeth. So he reminds me a little bit. Farkas had braces, but the look on his face and the fact that he's a redhead and everything reminds me of Scott Farkas from A Christmas Story. Look up the image. You guys will know what I'm talking about. But anyways, other than that, yeah, I'm really, really glad and relieved that the tie-in to House of Brainiac is in our backup story and not in our main story, because this series started by going two issues, then getting sucked into an event, and now it's issue 10, not even 12, issue 10, and we're already tying something else into yet another event, and I'm getting fucking sick of it. But we had a rant about that. I don't know what episode it was. I ranted about it, so see previous episode XYZ for that. But just as a note, even though it's just the backup, it still pisses me off, but only slightly less because it is the backup.
Yeah, this is going to greatly depend on how it how it all wraps up. Yeah. I mean, it's good to see Guy. It's good to see Guy actually doing something as opposed to most of these other Lanterns, even if we're, when we're getting to see them, with maybe the exception of Jessica. We haven't seen any of, and even that, actually, the last issue was mostly Jessica talking, to be honest. So she really didn't do much of anything either. But conceptually, she had been doing stuff. We just saw the recap of it. I don't know. I think it's a wait and see. I don't like Lobo. Lobo, you know, it's been pretty well established. I don't like Lobo, period, anyway. So this tying in a Brainiac event, having an army of Zarnians, it's like, yeah, that's like right up there. Let's throw Darkseid in, and other than that, I don't know how much less appealing you could make it to me. Let's have the United Planets involved, too. I mean, I guess I could come up with a checklist of things that would make me hate it even more, or not care even more. But we'll see. I have, at least Jeremy is writing this story, so at least it's the same writer, so at least there should be some continuity of, in a way. But even though it's the other book, it's a John Stewart book, that seems more likely where we're going to see, potentially see Guy next anyway, even though maybe not. We'll see. I still would have preferred more pages in the main story, but it didn't exactly turn me off. It just, but it's kind of there. I was too busy thinking of the first story after I read it. Anyway.
Last thing I'll say about this backup, and I just made sure to Google it because I thought I remembered something about a connection between Space Dolphins and Lobo, but I don't remember exactly what it was. So I Googled it. Turns out their first appearance was in Justice League International, number 18. And apparently Lobo does indeed have a relationship with Space Dolphins. It's one of the only... It says here, are the one and only thing to provoke true feelings of love in the psychopathic bounty hunter Lobo. So clearly they're making it like a Cesarnian thing instead of just a Lobo thing, unless this is actually a fake out and this is indeed Lobo. But apparently Space Dolphins were always in some way connected with Lobo, and now they're making it a Cesarnian thing. And they were created by one of the people who wrote, was a part of the story, Kevin Maguire.
So that's a good tie-in. That's good continuity. Continuity is a plus. More times than not, anyway.
That's right. Their first appearance in Justice League International 18 in 1988. So that is definitely a continuity stretch back. All right. Main issue stuff.
All right. So let's go to the main issue. Generally speaking, I thought this book was mostly... And this is where I'm going with the positives. I thought this was an interesting book in the sense... And if there was any chance this book's momentum was going to kind of start going down the road of... War Journal, I think this was a little more, we got a little more answers to some of the stuff that was going on, and the pacing for the most part was good. So that's what I liked. Now let's talk about the stuff I didn't like. I don't like the way, first of all, and this, it's weird about this part. My initial thoughts, so let me stick with it, was I don't like the way people are talking to Hal, not Kyle, but I don't like the way Joe talks to Hal. Joe seems to always have an attitude talking to Hal. I don't like the way, I mean, I'll cut Simon some slack only because Simon's just annoying to me, period. So he could probably be as he could be written as neutrally as possible with even a hint of having an attitude. And I might be a little more biased than I would normally try to be. But I don't like the way people treat Hal like he's an idiot when it comes to stuff. And I understand we get an explanation for the main reason any of these people know what's going on here. You can assume it's because of Salak being being hidden down in the center. Being in the center, like knowing about the catacombs and all the stuff that Hal doesn't know about, when you think Hal would know about it more than anybody else, that at least, but you know, Simon's saying, well, you know, whatever he said, like, I'm not, you know, what does he say? I'm not new at this or whatever, or I know what I'm doing, or whatever the hell he says it with an attitude, which is still laughable because compared to Hal, no, the answer is you don't know what you're doing and you don't know anything. But I don't like, and just like, and this is the counter to this, going hand in hand with it, I don't like why Hal is being written so ridiculously naive. Why would he not think it's possible? Why would he like need like the smoking gun to believe that the United Planets or Tharos is behind this? Why would he trust them? He didn't trust them to begin with. Really, that's why he friggin' left. So why is it so difficult for him to get on board with the idea that, oh, there could be corruption here? Like he didn't friggin' see it when the Guardians were there. There's something about that that's not there's other things I want to talk about, but that's all wrapped into one area. So that So if I had to pick one of those two things that really eats at me, it's why Hal is being written so ridiculously, golly gee, Fonz, and so naive about thinking that the United Planets is up to no good. Why, you know, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, no, I agree with you on that point. I don't necessarily know. It's in terms of people treating Hal the way they're treating him, I don't have as much of a problem with that just because it's Hal. Hal always does the half-cocked, going in without a plan type of bullshit all the time. And it's just been a while since some of these people have experienced it, or not at all in the case of Joe. She may have had some experience with it last issue, but not enough to realize that. And plus, they're like, they're in the situation where they're being hunted and they're living underground. And then, yes, it's a guy that they know and trust, but he's coming in not understanding any part of the situation. He's late to the party. He's not understanding the seriousness of, or he is understanding the seriousness, but they feel he's not understanding the seriousness and the gravity of the situation and not realizing this isn't something you can just fucking brute force your way through. You know, Kelly's life is in danger, you know, so on and so forth. But I do agree with you on why the hell does he trust them? Because part of the reason he left was because he didn't trust them. So what? Interesting. I will say, I don't know if you want to expand on that, but just interesting. Some other things I found here. These guards that are using repurposed Manhunter armor and have these staves that if they touch you, you lose your connection to the source. So your ring goes offline. It's interesting because I think, I don't know, maybe she just mentions it way too subtly. It's interesting that Joe kind of says that to Hal before he actually experiences it. And he doesn't tell her, oh, I have my ring is different than what you have. So it's not really going to matter here.
He may not know they can potentially do the same thing to him under the right circumstance. So, yes. Even though it does answer one question we had, you and I kind of debated a little bit last issue about whether Joe would need a ring from the foundry as a versus, because her ring's different and she may, no, the answer is yes. If you want a ring that's going to work the same way that's a fail-safe ring like Hal has, you have to get one from the foundry. So Joe would have to get one. Everybody in that group would have to get one. But still creates the problem that there aren't enough rings yet.
Well, no, it doesn't, because I was listening to podcast of Oa's coverage of that issue, and it's John. John doesn't need a ring. John has his own power. He is not a lantern anymore.
Well, we talked about it could have been John. We said it could have been a bunch, but you and I butted heads on Joe because you thought Joe would.
I did.
Yeah,
I did.
Because when we talked about Simon, because Simon didn't even have a ring the last time we saw, and we talked. So no matter how you slice it, everybody who's an Earth Lantern needed to get one of these rings. Some people would be waiting because they only had six ready to go.
Yeah.
And yes, and we did talk about John because of the fact that the Guardians could have basically used Guardian foresight to realize that that by the time this are assumed by the time this would ever come into fruition that John would already have ascended.
Or Book of Oa, which we'll talk about some other
we will. And I also understand that if you know Salak has issues with Hal, so Salak is kind of like poisoning the well subtly by giving him, well, you have to be careful with. It bothers me more coming from Joe because Joe doesn't know shit in the big picture related to the Green Lantern Corps. She knows even less than Simon. So it bothers me when she kind of like has a borderline attitude or is talking. Oh, like when she pushes Hal. Now, of course, she didn't have to just push. She could have just told him what she was going to do instead of just pushing him blindly. It's like, hey, we have to go down there. Remember, don't use your ring. Just jump. Trust me. She didn't have to just push him either. I mean, that's a good, it's almost like she was doing that on purpose to see if he would use his rings just so she could yell at him if he did. But just the way, hey, you know, you're better at taking orders than I heard. It's like, than I whatever thought. It's like, it's just, I don't know. It's just, it bothers me. It just bothers me. Another thing that makes no sense, it doesn't make any sense when they had that guinea pig lantern going into the source that Theros is pushing. Why is he going mine when he's red?
Yeah, coloring mistake there for sure.
I'm going to assume it was a coloring mistake because yes, he's talking about mine. So you would assume he would be channeling orange, but yet he's got the red, but he does not have the orange lantern symbol, or he's not orange. So that doesn't make any sense. trying to think. There was something. I thought there was something else, and maybe it'll come to me when you talk about something. But
yeah, you mentioned in your recap that the reason that these lanterns are able to change emotional spectrum energy is because they have been putting magic users on the team. That I didn't get that, so I was going back and reading it. Joe is only referring to magic users in that she says, "We think the United Planets has given new rings to a few magic users stationed somewhere on Oa. If someone uses source power, then they can pinpoint where and send troops to find them." So she's talking about the three lanterns that Jessica's going to, the unseen, at the end. I don't think every lantern who can change color is a magic user.
I thought when I reread it today, there was another reference to, I want to see where she talks about the color shifting, because I thought there was something else that tied into magic when but what, let's see.
She does talk about like veterans were being sent far away, and inside of a week their rings were returned. Something was killing them off.
They could change the emotional spectrum color.
Yeah, but she doesn't say anything about them being magic users to do so.
But it still could be the magic use that's causing it, but we don't know. You're right. I'm connecting dots that we don't necessarily know connect. But yes, I actually interpreted your way the first time, and then I read it the second time, and it's like, or vice versa. And it's like, I thought they were trying to imply that there was a connection there. I don't know. Seeing 2-6 was nice. That was a plus.
That was true. Yep.
That was a plus. The Kelly thing, I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of Kelly to begin with. At least it's good continuity that she's friggin' been in a coma for like 2 years or whatever. Or like a year and a half in comic book time, in our time. In comic book time, it's probably like a couple of weeks, really. But in their time. I think ultimately my biggest issue with this issue is just, first of all, we damn well know the unseeing have to know that Jessica is a plant, because how the hell would they not? If they're good at their job, they would clearly know that she's a plant.
If they are what they say they are.
Yeah. Yes. But the real issue I have is just why Hal would be so ridiculous. You know, Hal has enough issue with authority to begin with. He really wouldn't have to twist his arm about the idea that people in power are not up to any good, and that absolute power corrupts absolutely. So, and that's another thing that I thought was when Joe was kind of going down that road. It's like, yeah, of all people, Hal's not going to, nobody needs to tell Hal about absolute power potentially corrupting absolutely. So it was an entertaining issue, but there's a lot. I think that at least based on what we have in this issue by itself, there's a lot of holes. So if they don't get filled in a little more tightly, I did like Kyle being a friggin' mess, which makes sense because he of all of these lanterns, he's the only one who would have this tie to the emotional spectrum. I do like the fact that I hate the fact that somehow it ties into that stupid Sinister Sons thing, but we get the reference to the fact that they have as of this book, the Sinestro Corps central power battery has not been destroyed yet. They tried, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
At least it opens the door for maybe Sinestro and the Sinestro Corps being a factor in resolving this. Not that that's necessarily a good thing, but it would potentially make sense, and Sinestro was kind of courting favor with them on one level, but you knew Sinestro wouldn't trust them at all. So Sinestro would probably have fail safes too. Yeah. But I don't know. It was entertaining, but again, the characterization of Hal on this, not leaping into action, because yes, that is Hal. But Hal did it for the right reason, because of the way he says, like, we're lanterns, we always have choices. So he was choosing to act and give it a shot, as opposed to, well, let's just let them keep torturing the kid and do whatever they're doing with her just because we haven't figured out the best way or the safest way to get her out. And it's like, screw that. And it turned out on that level, they didn't get her, but they could have gotten her.
Yeah. So. I think the last thing I'll say is, DC, do you not want us to read the solicits? And if so, why do you put them out? If you want us to read them and you put them out the way they do, because the end of this issue says next, wedding bells. And the solicit for Green Lantern 11 reads, "The fate of Hal Jordan and Carol Ferris. How do you move on from the person you've loved your entire life? How do you start over? Carol wrestles with her feelings, blah, 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 blah." Okay. And then the cup, one of the covers for issue 12 is a really beautiful, I don't know if you've seen it, Mark, the cover by Zermonico of Hal and Carol kissing.
I don't know. I don't know if I have.
It's a really, I actually like, it's the, I do like a lot of Zermonico's covers, just not all of them. And this is probably my favorite of all the ones he's done so far. I just sent you a link so you can pull up and see what I'm talking about. But it's a really pretty cover. So the solicit says next wedding bells. The end of the issue says next wedding bells. The solicit for 11 tells us that Carol's going to be entering the picture, and the cover for issue 12 confirms it. So why are we spoiling so many fucking things? Like the other stuff we've talked about on the show has, especially recently, has been way more spoilery and on the nose, like that solicit for War Journal that spoiled the whole Ellie Rose kind of being reincarnated thing. This is obviously more subtle than that, but why do they insist on fucking doing this? It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I'm just even reading the solicit, that solicit for number 12. And it's like, which doesn't, it certainly doesn't indicate that the story ends in issue 12.
Yeah. But that's a cool ass cover.
Oh, it is a nice cover. There's no doubt it's a nice cover, but yeah. I'm just saying that, I don't know. I was kind of hoping this thing was going to have a little more oomph to it for me when they went into space, and it's still early, but I'm not getting that vibe yet off the first issue and a half of it.
Well, yeah, because we spent the entire issue underground.
Yeah. And there was a whole lot of, telling, not showing, which again, you need to do to a certain extent. And even honestly, knowing what the solicit is for next issue, that almost seems like that's going to be another one where, depending how much time is spent with Carol, that just kind of, I mean, based on where we are in this issue, going back to Earth to deal with Carol, to say that would be coming out of left field is being kind. So, I mean, I know you might be able to tie it in somehow to what's going on with the emotional spectrum, but that didn't seem to have any kind of effect on her during the issues when she was on Earth and we were there. So I don't know. This is still the best book of the three, I know, and that's not, it's becoming increasingly shaky praise because the other two books are in various stages of to not to please. But I don't know. I like this book. I like Jeremy. I'm not sure if I really still like where this is going. But like we said about the guy story, I guess we're going to have to wait to see where we end up to see if it was, if we'd like the journey or not.
All right. Are we done with the issue?
I think so.
All right. Where are we going next?
Feedback, I think. I think we'll play a little catch up on feedback. So we'll do Corwin has two voicemails, and one's related to a previous discussion we had actually a Joe. So we'll do that. We'll probably do that one first. And then he has some feedback related to our famous first episode from two weeks ago.
All right, which one are we starting with?
Let's do the Joe one.
Hey, guys, Corwin again. Got a call back in about this whole booty thing, and it's really more than that. I think it really boils down to the fact that there's a stereotypical, quote-unquote, attractive, pencil skinny woman. And, you know, we're joking about ass, but it's a lot more than that. There are definitely more body types than what's portrayed in comics and their, quote, ideal body type. So while we may joke about Joe's ass and stuff, it's a real problem that they need to look into. We need to represent more different kinds of body types. There's more than one type of body in the world. And, you know, the characters should reflect some of that. You guys can go look at Larry Stroman. He used to do X-Factor, Life and Times of Lucas Bishop. He drew body types of all shapes and sizes and some thickness as well. But, yeah, check that out. Now, the whole Milo Manara Spider-Woman thing, Milo Manara is an erotic artist. That is his thing. Google some of his stuff. You may have to take the safe search off because that is what he's known for. So I don't understand why Marvel commissioned that cover and expected anything less from the man. That's his thing. Looking forward to hearing more feedback on this topic. Oh, yeah. That ass.
Well, that was good. Oh, Corwin, you make us laugh.
But I agree. I mean, I agree with him, but also nobody wants to see my body type on the in the comics. I mean, unless they do, and their favorite character is X-Men Blob.
Oh God. we gotta draw a chat. Zoom in. No, but all kidding aside, Corwin, his point is valid that in general, and it's not just in comic book art. We see that as a problem in all forms of media. But yes, that the stereotypical one form of body type. It's not just, and it is definitely not just related to the backside and things like that. But yes, there's one set standards, you know, by standard of beauty or body type for superheroes, or you know, and it's true for guys too. It's just it's more. Because guys read the predominant audience, that it makes sense that it may be a little more
appealing to the male gaze.
Yes. So they may zero in on that stereotype, even it may be more problematic than having, you know, almost all superheroes, especially in a modern age, kind of look more like or drawn like Captain America's body. As opposed to like the early 60s when at least, you know, none of the heroes had that kind of development, but certainly like if it was more natural for Peter Parker being a teenager to be less, you know, more thin and less developed than, let's say, if you were like Thor and things like that. So it is a valid point. So I thought that was good. And no, we were not delaying that for any other reason other than the fact that it really didn't seem to fit with any other episode up until now. And since since Joe is in this issue, even though I don't even remember if we see her backside in this issue.
She's wearing her little clandestine cloak.
Well, that's right. She's wearing her jacket or her robe. You're right. So we would never know. Maybe they let the robe out a little bit, but yeah. So, but this was the most appropriate episode yet to revisit.
I think we do see it briefly when she drops down to join Hal in the fight and the cloak is flying upward. She looks rail thin.
And that's what I'm not going to lie. I already closed the issue, but that was my recollection too. There wasn't anything in this issue that would draw your attention. And that's the kind of the point, like we talked about, that they don't draw her looking like the way Jamal Adams draws her, that she's definitely a different body type. But when everybody else draws her, you wouldn't be able to distinguish her from the back. Then from
Jamal Campbell.
What did I say?
Jamal Adams.
Oh, you're right. I'm combining. I think sports and Jeremy Adams and everything else. Oh my God. But yes, Jamal. The reality is, yeah, from the backside, you probably wouldn't be able to just distinguish her from Carol or from Jessica or anybody else, and that's the problem. So.
Yeah. All right. His second voicemail then.
Yes, let's do the second one.
Hey, guys, it's Corwin. Just listen to your latest episode. You guys had me rolling with the Spider-Man stuff and J. Jonah Jameson Jr., JJ, was actually Peter Parker's almost brother-in-law. Well, they were brothers, actually, because Aunt May had married Jameson's father before he passed. So the two of them were in-laws for a while. I know you're not quite happy with J. Jonah Jameson's relationship with Peter now, but it was pretty awesome how they grew the two of them together. And after the whole world forgot who Spider-Man was, Peter did eventually reveal to JJ who he was. Don't sleep on it. It was actually really, really good storytelling over a pretty decent amount of time that brought the two of them together. And then, of course, him helping Spidey sometimes hurts more than helps, but it's been pretty awesome. Just wanted to let you guys know that. All right. Talk to you later.
I think that one was more for you, Chad.
Only because
you're the one who mentioned the JJ, the J. Jonah Jameson stuff specifically.
See, now I got to pull up the web browser because this is the second time it's come up and I don't know what the actual issue was where he talked to Jonah.
Yeah, I wasn't reading that. I did kind of vaguely remember him, I think because they talked, probably because it was just pushed and they talked about it, whether it was on Newsarama or other stuff. I don't remember when it was, but I did kind of remember that he did reveal himself at one point, just like I did kind of remember when Corwin's talking about the about Aunt May's relationship with Jonah's father or whatever, and it's like, yeah, I did. It did kind of ring a bell. I did ring a little bit of a bell. It's not like one of the most famous relationships that, to me, in my mind, when I think of different people Aunt May was involved with, I think Doc Ock more. but it did kind of ring a bell a little bit. But that was much later in the Spider-Man experience for me, when I pretty much wasn't reading the book on a regular basis anymore.
It was from the Chip Zdarsky run of Spider-Man, or was it Amazing? No, so it's issue 6 of Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man. So if anybody was wondering what I was talking about, issue 6, Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man, by Chip Zdarsky. I think it's the whole thing. It might be parallel to some sort of other POV character's story arc, and these are just interspersed scenes, but if I remember it right, I thought it was the whole issue. Just takes place with Spider-Man and Jonah in a room talking to each other the entire time. And he reveals who he is to Jonah. And you get some nice backstory on Jonah and why he is the way he is and everything. It's still like the modern interpretation. And this is a very extreme example, but it's kind of like the Vader thing for me. Like, how can Vader be redeemed after all the shit he did?
He can't. He's <It's> closed.
And it's the same. It's obviously to a much lesser extent, but arguably to a pretty severe extent for Jonah, is he did a lot of shit. And even if he did it with the wrong, a wacky, you know, happenstance, coincidences going on in the background that made it worse than he actually ever intended it to be, it doesn't matter. He really fucked up a lot of times. So I don't know that I fully buy, you know, happy-go-lucky Jonah.
I also have a hard time, not really, and this is very little related to Jonah. The mere fact that you mentioned the Spectacular Spider-Man, it still irks me to this day that they can't, that with that being the second ongoing monthly Spider-Man book, that they actually canceled that book at the end of the Clone Saga just to continue other books instead. As opposed to, now I understand the book was called Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man. Now, of course, if probably everybody knew for a fact that it was going to be at some point, you know, go back to Peter as Spider-Man, the way eventually it all played out. I just think it might have been. It just bothered me that they just scrapped the Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man in the actual title, and then eventually they just got rid of that book and they went on with, and they, especially because they changed, the McFarlane book was like Spider-Man. I think they changed the name of it to Peter Parker Spider-Man after the Clone Saga completely came to an end and Norman Osborn was back. And it's like, really? You're renaming another book Peter Parker, you know, as opposed to the one that you had since 1978 or whatever, or 76, whatever it was, and you got rid of it. It's like, yeah, that as a Spider-Man fan with that second book that started in 76, which I had that first issue, it always bothered me. But that's neither here nor there, really. Jameson is, there are some redeeming qualities, I suppose. He's not a total douche, but in the comic books he was less douchey in a way in the movies, like I think you mentioned, it compared to the comics. In the comics he really was borderline irredeemable, certainly for a long period of time.
Yeah. There's been, you know, as Mark mentioned, there was another series of the same name. So you're not just looking for issue 6. So look for the Zdarsky written issue. It's the cover. I don't know if it's a variant cover, if it was the main cover, but the cover is an old style, like circular type cover, you know, where a lot of the cover is blank except for one circle, which focuses in on detail. And it's Spidey sitting across from, Jonah at a dining table. So that's what you're looking for. But yeah, I get what Corwin's saying. I don't have it in me to buy Jonah has turned heel since this particular issue of Spider-Man, or before or since or whatever. It's never gonna happen for me.
Turned face.
Whatever. Yeah. I forget you have a thing about that. I don't know what else to say. I don't know why I'm trying to expand on this. That's all there is to say about that.
Yeah, that's right. Nothing more to say about that right now. she should do an entire episode like that one day.
Oh, God, I don't know.
A commentary track. All right, so let's do one more piece of feedback. Let's do Monty, this one's for you. The something completely different that was turned out to be something completely the same. Hello, Lantern Cast. Monty here, writing from stormy West Ireland. My phone provider won't let me send you a voice message. That was supposed to be the completely different thing. So I'm going to write a transcript instead. Try and imagine an English accent. Why can't we just speak like Forrest instead? Hello, Lantern Cast. Monty here. Here's the completely different thing. An audio email. Lies! First, I wanted to add birthday wishes to Mark, too, as I didn't realize his birthday was around then. Mark Marble, the March Marvel. Nice. My good wishes for Chad alone must have been devastating for you. Laughs. So happy birthday to you both. For the record, I'm at episode 364, King of the Monsters review. Only 200 episodes to go. He's catching up. Current issue comments, Green Lantern number 9, so much happened. Green Lantern War Journal number 7, so little happened. All true. Also, for the record, I won't be picking up any of the other parts of the Superman crossover, just the Green Lantern issues. I'm assuming he means Brainiac.
Yeah, probably.
Brainiac. I'm a bit jaded about being mildly disappointed by Night Terrors and massively disappointed by Dark Crisis. I don't think Williamson is great as a quote-unquote showrunner. Give Tom Taylor a go, I say. Give him an in-universe crisis and let him kill a bunch of super focus. He does seem to enjoy that. Okay, that's about it. Next time, my notes on the next generation of the Lantern Cast. That's you guys, I think, even though if he's doing King of the Monsters, he's already into us, obviously, for a while.
Yeah.
But only kidding. That was me. Oh, yeah, don't forget the most important thing. Line goes dead. So maybe something was lost in translation there, but at least I didn't have to worry about the two-minute thing. I'll figure out a way to actually give you guys a voice message sometime without losing arm or leg. Bye. Thanks for the attempt, Monty. We appreciate it.
You said 394?
64.
364. Got it.
Yeah. You did your best, Monty. That's what's so tragic. No, only kidding. Yeah, so.
Yeah, he's June 7th, 2019. That's when that came out. That's when our review of it hit, so I'm assuming it was 2019.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah, that might be right, actually. That might be right, actually. I could tell you. I could tell you in one second for one reason. Yes, it was. It was 20. King of the Monsters was May 31st, 2019, because I did have something I wanted to say before we wrap up. So that's, I had that open, so that was kind of convenient. Convenient. So, yeah, pretty much everything, you kind of hit the nails on pretty much every head there.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. He talks about give Tom Taylor a go. Well, I mean, you're close, but no cigar. Have you heard about Absolute Comics? Did you hear about this?
Refresh my memory and I'll tell you if I heard anything of it.
News, quote unquote news, broke for this on Monday by Rich Johnson over at Bleeding Cool, who I hesitate very strongly to call a journalist. Based on a direct interaction I've had with him in the past, but that's neither here nor there. Essentially, there's supposed to be, and the reporting on this is, you know, questionable at best, quote unquote reporting, because nearly every comment on the article is like, okay, so this is news about what exactly? I'm still unclear on what exactly you're even talking about. Apparently, there's supposed to be a new line or print label, kind of like Black Label, I guess, maybe. Led by Scott Snyder, and it's been referred to in the hush-hush meetings at DC as Absolute DC, and it's all, you know, it's all being done under Scott Snyder. He's the sort of herald of all of this, the director of all this. So I know I sound very unsure about what it is. That's because if Rich is right, apparently he's very unsure of what it is, because he makes absolutely no sense in his articles. But you can go find it if you want to. Just search Absolute Comics. But it's apparently DC's creating their own Ultimate line led by Scott Snyder.
Golly.
Golly gee willikers.
Yeah. Won't be losing sleep over that one.
I mean, if there's Green Lantern stuff, we'll talk about it in some form or another. I'm not promising any reviews, but we've been doing this for 15 years, guys. Like, that's what happens. Something Green Lantern comes out, we talk about it. This is not going to change a fucking thing for us. We're definitely not going to be invested in DC Absolute. At least I'm not. I'll take the same approach I take to everything. If it sounds interesting, I'm in. But I'm not going to buy everything.
No.
Learned my lesson when I bought everything Dark Crisis related.
Oh, God. I still don't get that one. But you were more golly gee fonds than Hal Jordan was in this issue.
Yeah.
Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man, number one. I love that issue. Oh, life.
So the other thing, are we done with Monty's email?
Yeah.
I didn't really. Okay. So I wanted to mention, I told Mark about this, but I've been keeping an eye on the Upper Decks trading card game, the Versus system, that they have a Green Lantern Corps DC Versus system trading card game out there. And I've talked about it in the past. I don't think a lot on the actual show, but when I've done card unboxings, I reference it. And I was actually able to open like five or six packs of it. That I did a whole separate YouTube video over on Lantern Cast Vids. But sealed booster boxes of this thing have, and you'll see if you watch the video where I opened only a couple of packs of it, I have an actual screenshot from eBay at the time where sealed booster boxes of this were like $200, $300, some of them even $400, just based on, you know, I don't know, just what people seem to think these were worth. So I've just been occasionally searching for this on eBay and just following every single listing that I thought was within reason or potential to come down in price. Because if you follow or watch something on eBay, it's called watching. If you watch it and the listing doesn't sell and gets reposted, you are still listed as watching that item. So, you know, if it doesn't sell, maybe they'll mark it down and I'll see that marked down in my watches. Well, tax return season hit. I got my tax return and I'm doing a couple of things with my tax return and then also my paycheck hit at the same time. And this just so happens to be a month where I get three paychecks this month instead of two. So just based on the way the calendar worked out. So an extra paycheck plus the tax return. I was like, you know what? I can splurge on something for myself. I'm already planning on getting like a new computer for myself, but that's a need. That's, you know, I work from home. I need a new computer. But I finally saw one of these Versus system booster boxes go on sale for $175, which is the lowest I'd seen it. And maybe y'all think that's crazy to pay that much for a trading card game or whatever. But based on prior history of this pricing, this is pretty low. So I was like, you know what? You know, plus it was around my birthday on the 6th. So I was like, I'll pull the trigger. So I bought myself finally this thing. It's 24 cards, 24 packs per box, 14 cards per pack. And what's interesting about this, and I'm saying it to you all now, and just in case you never saw the original video, because I did mention it in the video, this thing is copyright 2005. The Panini Games Green Lantern TCG is from 2017, and they're beautiful cards, especially the foils, because the foils always look really cool and shiny and multicolored. But the thing about the Panini Games one is it just used existing art from Green Lantern covers that were happening during that time. So it's all art you've seen before. This is, for the most part, the art on these cards is not art pulled from the comics. And since it's 2005, you're not really at the height of the emotional spectrum Geoff Johns stuff just yet, because Rebirth is just about to start, right? Isn't that the same year, right? Like 05, 06, something like that?
That started in 04.
04. So we're kind of on the tail end of it. We're kind of getting there, kind of not. I don't think we've seen the Sinestro Corps uniform yet, because we saw, we've seen a couple of things. But yeah, like anyways, instead of getting a bunch of cards in here that are based off of emotional spectrum members, like obviously there's going to be some Star Sapphire stuff and some Sinestro stuff because that existed prior to 2005. But instead of getting a bunch of villains like Atrocitus or Larfleeze or whatever, you're getting cards that reference like the anti-Green Lantern Corps that appeared for that one issue, which Dan did a video on and everything. You're getting a lot of there's a Lord Malvolio card in here. Weirdly enough, maybe it just is kismet. One, because it's part of a larger DC TCG that you can integrate these cards into, you can play them standalone as Green Lantern, or you can integrate them into the larger DC TCG as their versus system cards. There are in this set some random just standard DC characters in here, but they don't take up most of the set. It's only a couple of cards. One of them, for some reason, they decided... it's kismet. They decided to put a Ragman card in the Green Lantern TCG. So there's a Ragman card in here somewhere to be found. But also, I mentioned the art in the Panini Games one. This is all original art that you've never seen before. I tried to watch a video on gameplay for this card game. The cards, their design, their layout, and everything look like Magic the Gathering cards, which I never understood how to play. Closest I got to Magic type gameplay was the Yu-Gi-Oh card game, but I'm just going to go for a master set of these. I'm mentioning it now because this was an expensive booster box, and I actually, because of the original prices on this, I never thought we were going to unbox this on our YouTube channel. It is taking everything in me not to... That's it. That's my booster box. It's taking me everything in me not to open this up right now without the camera rolling. So please, when the video posts, go give it a watch and comment on it. Let's interact about this thing, because I really want to geek out about this set with somebody, but that requires y'all watching the video and geeking out about it in the comments. I'm not going for high views or anything like that. I'm not trying to increase our exposure on YouTube or anything like that, but this I loved and had like a special interest in all the card unboxings I've done. But this one is a very special one and a very expensive one. So if you're curious about this, I think by the time this episode goes up, the YouTube video should be up. But if on the off chance it's not, it will be up in a couple of days for you listeners. So check out the Lantern Cast Vids YouTube channel, because I'm very excited about this.
Give Chet a break, people.
No, it's always a catch-22 with content creation, because like, we do this for us, we do this for the fans, we don't do this for monetary gain or whatever, we're having fun. But also, like, at some point when you get to doing this for as long as we have, like, is it about how many listens we get? No, but if more people listen and more people interact, we get to geek out together with the community about something, which depends on their interaction. So we want to have more people listen or watch. So it's always a strange game to play.
Yeah, it is. But you're done good, Chad.
But that, I think as we record this, it's Wednesday. So I will probably be unboxing this this weekend. So that'll be fun.
Should be fun. Sounds interesting. I look forward to it.
All right. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, let's just, as we wrap all this stuff up, As an epilogue to our Godzilla and Kong episode, not that this is shocking, because we kind of mentioned this last week, that as we speak, we're recording this on, the 17th, that Godzilla X Kong will, in all likelihood, there's a chance it might not if it really drops a lot this weekend, but it's going to absolutely catch Kong Skull Island domestically to be number two in all time in the franchise. It's at 160.3. It's got to get to 168. So it's probably going to settle in at number two, no matter what. I don't think it's got enough life in it to get to the 200.6 of 2014 Godzilla, but it will settle in number two domestically at least. And worldwide, it's less than 10 million away from Godzilla versus Kong, like we talked about. So it will settle into third place behind Skull Island and 2014 Godzilla. Almost guaranteed that's where it's going to stay, because I don't think it's got another $70 million left in it to, 79 million technically, to be able to catch Godzilla. But it's performed well. I think in a way it's more impressive looking at Godzilla versus Kong, because again, if not for the, when it was released and the stupid day and date decision by WB, that movie would almost assuredly have made between $500 and $530 million worldwide. I don't know if it ever would have caught Skull Island, but I think it would have had a real chance to catch the 2014 Godzilla. So that movie, considering when it came out, did well. But this is still nothing to shake a stick at. I mean, you've only had one movie go over 200 domestically. So this one not doing it isn't shocking. And you've only had two movies go over 500 million in this franchise. So even if Godzilla X Kong cannot get there, which I don't think it will, but still, being number three isn't so bad on the list. Smallest budget, that helps.
Yeah, my opinion of it hasn't changed, though. I think it's still my weakest of the franchise. As I said in our episode, it doesn't mean I hated the issue. It just means, it doesn't mean I hated the movie. It just means it's my least favorite of a pretty good franchise thus far. So
I still want to see it again before it leaves, which has been complicated. Here's another cute little aside in case. If you have this experience at your Regal, I would like to know, because my Regal, and it's not just my Regal, I know, and their infinite wisdom, I think, trying to save payroll between now and when Planet of the Apes comes out, they literally have wiped out all the second evening sets starting the week we're in now. So basically it started right after last Thursday going forward until the week of Planet of the Apes, that there's no second evening sets, even on the weekend. So if you're lucky, if you can get an 8 o'clock start at my Regal, even on a Friday night or a Saturday night, which is really stupid in my opinion. But it has greatly complicated the next few weeks of movie going, since we're so used to doing the late movies. And now we have to scramble to find something that is not too close to seven, which becomes really logistically a nightmare, but yet still fits into somewhere late 7:30, 7:40, 50. So that's why we're seeing The First Omen this week, which I had no desire to see. And the other option was seeing Abigail, which I actually still don't, I have even less of a desire to see because I'm so sick of the trailer. But maybe next week that'll see Kong and Godzilla one last time, depending on when the only evening start is. And the only reason I found this out, Ungentlemanly Warfare, we had tickets for the late showing of that this coming Thursday on the 18th, and they canceled it because Regal's funny. They don't bother letting you know why they cancel something. You just get the refund email telling you, and you can then, because of experience, you can connect the dots to why. And then eventually the ticket disappears from your purchase list, but not right away on the app, which is also confusing potentially to people. But they have a showing, and it's pretty uniform, which I find funny. They have a uniformed evening showing, like almost at all Regals, for Ungentlemanly Warfare. And it's friggin' 6 o'clock on Thursday night. Why bother? 6 o'clock is not your quintessential time. You would think of all movies, you would want to have that one be the latest start, if possible, in the first and only evening set to allow more people to see it if they wanted to. 6 o'clock is a shitty time to go see a movie on a Thursday night for most people. So. But that's it. One led to the other, but so maybe that was two things, but that's it.
Meanwhile, I'm still over here waiting to see Godzilla Minus One for the first time.
You'll enjoy it, though.
Yeah, so I was looking up, like, have we had a date announced yet for the U.S. home video release? And I know the Japan one is in May, but I found someone talking about it. It says, using the same Japanese to U.S. release window as Shin Godzilla, puts Minus One's American Blu-ray release in September. So if they stick to the pattern they did when they were releasing Shin Godzilla, we won't see Minus One until September. So let's hope that window shrinks significantly.
Yeah, which is interesting because I think the Blu-ray of Godzilla X Kong isn't supposed to come out till like New Year's Eve. At least, I think when Amazon shows it, I think that's what the date that they show it, that it's not supposed to be available to the end of the year. So, which is still a little.
That makes no sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense considering we're only in April. But I happened to notice that when I was looking for stuff on Amazon. So,
I mean, at the very least, I could see them like pushing it back to like, you know, December. So, you know, early December, late November for Christmas presents, because, you know, as we all know, I don't agree with it, but the physical media market is dying a little bit, quite a little bit. So they could use the sales boost of it being a holiday gift, but it's even then, it still doesn't make sense. It should be coming out in like, well, September, August, something like that, realistically speaking.
Yeah, I don't know.
All right.
So. Lanterncast@gmail.com if you want to email us. Website, lanterncast.com. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, #geocast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, whichever platform you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or voicemail, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
All right, guys. We'll talk to you later.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.